This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, beginning an oral history interview with Colonel John Ewell of the United States Air Force. Today's date is the 12th of October, 2004. I am in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and I'm speaking with John by telephone. And John, you're in Fort Worth, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Good afternoon, first of all.
Good afternoon.
And I want to thank you for taking some time today to participate in the Oral History Project.
No problem.
And is it all right if I call you John?
It's all right.
Okay, thank you. First, John, if you wouldn't mind, please give us a sense of, first of all, general biographical data, and then where you grew up. Where were you born and when?
Boswell, Indiana, 29 July, 1934.
And Boswell, Indiana is where from anywhere that we might have heard of?
Well, it's 7 miles due west of Oxford, Indiana.
Okay, I was going to ask, is that the county seat or something?
No.
Okay.
No, we're not going that big yet. Now, see, I don't want to rush you. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want to rush me into Hanoi. I don't want to rush you away from Boswell, Indiana.
Yes, sir.
Let me put it this way. It is approximately 20 miles straight west of Lafayette, Indiana,
okay.
Home of Purdue University.
Yes, sir. Did you grow up sort of in the shadow of Purdue?
I did.
Did you go over there much?
No, I didn't. I went to a business college in Lafayette, but I did not attend Purdue.
Okay, but, well, I'm from Michigan, and I know that, rural Michigan, and I know that the big, you know, state universities do cast a shadow, that's for sure.
That is correct, and if you grew up in rural Michigan, and that's Boswell, Indiana, is 1,000 people.
Okay.
So it is essentially a rural community.
Yes, sir. Now, what about your family? Tell me about your dad, first of all.
Okay. My father was a funeral director,
mm-hmm.
and he grew up in Indiana also. His father was in the railroad. He was with the railroad, and my father, like I say, a funeral director, so he was self-employed. I am one of six children.
Mm-hmm.
I am the oldest. After me were three girls. And then two more boys.
Tell me a little bit about the family business. Was that an established business that your father bought into, or did he create it on his own?
Created it.
Really?
Yeah.
How did
yeah.
he happen to do this in Boswell?
He worked as an embalmer for the only funeral home in Boswell.
Uh-huh.
And then he, when the owner of the funeral home for which he worked died, he started his own funeral home, and the wife of his former employer continued the funeral home, so he was in competition
okay.
with the funeral home he had worked at prior, but she didn't remain in business very long, and then he was the sole funeral director in the little town of Boswell.
Okay. What was his name?
John Arthur.
And is that also your name?
John Harry.
Okay. Where does the Harry come from? Is it a family name as well?
Yeah. Interesting question. The Harry was the first name of the gentleman that he worked for.
Oh, is that right?
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
He must have had a great deal of respect for
that.
He
did.
Gentleman.
He did. He thought very highly of Harry Simpkins, not so highly of Harry Simpkins' wife.
Sometimes that happens.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, that is not too uncommon.
Let me ask you a little bit about his father. You mentioned that he had worked for the railroad. In what capacity?
I'm sorry?
Your dad's father had worked for the railroad?
That is correct.
In what capacity?
He was a telegraph operator.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Does that mean anything to you?
Click, 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 click.
That's it. You got it. That's
okay.
When they used to communicate with the engineers on the trains,
mm-hmm.
and to other locations, other stations, via Morse code.
Now, what railroad would have been going through there that he worked for?
He worked for the Nickel Plate Railroad.
Tell me a little bit about that if you know anything, John.
Local. I don't know if
okay.
they I think they operated maybe in Kentucky. I don't know if it was, or maybe it was strictly an Indiana railroad.
So a small network, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about your mother? Tell me what you can about her. First of all, her name, her maiden name.
Marie.
Mm-hmm.
And she was one of 14 children.
Okay. Wow.
And this was a farming family.
Mm-hmm.
And her parents were German. In fact, they came from Germany.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And did they have their own land in the area?
Yes, they did. They bought a farm, and I forget. I want to say it was about 200 acres.
Really?
But I'm not sure. I know it wasn't big by today's standards, but it was average size by the size of farms back in the 30s and 40s.
Were they able to hold on to that through the Depression?
Yes. In fact, their youngest son still owns the home place. That's a term we use in rural Indiana.
Yes, sir. And he's still in the family business then?
No, he's now retired,
uh-huh.
but he lives on the at the home place.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, it is.
It really is. What kind of a woman was your mom? Can you talk about her for a little bit?
Yeah, she was probably one of the most impressive women I've ever known in my life. A very religious woman, a very hardworking woman, very very disciplined person.
Mm-hmm.
She was just, in fact. It's difficult for me to find fault with her. I know I'm sure I have a tremendous amount of bias cranked into my observation, but I really do, trying to be objective. I just difficult to find fault with that woman.
Now, any idea how old your parents were when did they know each other growing up?
No. Okay. Well, yes and no. No, the answer is no, they did not.
Okay.
They met, I think, they were in high school, although not in the same high school. But back in those days, in the 30s, there were a lot of little high schools.
Yes.
That was before consolidation.
Yes.
And I don't know if it was the same in Michigan or not. But
yes, it was, I think, yes.
Yeah, a lot of little schools. And my dad, of course, he was Boswell. That's where he went to school. And my mother went to this little school about 7 miles away, a little town called Ambia.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, wait a minute. No, that's not correct. Because there was a Catholic school out in the middle of the farmland,
mm-hmm.
and they used to have high school there, and she went to high school there. And then it was later they discontinued the high school part of the school, had 1 through 8 grades. And then so after she had gone to school, then they started going to this little town of Ambia for high school. But she actually went to school at this Catholic school in this little, just all there was a church,
mm-hmm.
the school, a little store, and 2 houses, and that was it, and the cemetery. And that was this huge town of Dunnington, Indiana, which is still there, but no school.
I was going to ask, is there still a...
Yeah, in fact, they've built 2 or 3 more houses. The
okay.
church is still in operation, although not nearly as active as it was back in those days. And the school's gone, the building's gone, just a vacant lot where the school used to be now. Let me just give you, can I work in just a quick war story here?
Please do, absolutely.
Okay, this has something, although it's a stretch, but it does in a very disconnected way tie in with my experience as a POW.
Okay.
When I used to go out to my grandparents' farm and spend the summers on the farm, probably about 3 summers in a row when I was probably about 10, 11, and 12, somewhere in that age range.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 year, I remember on the farm, and it was time to jerk sweet corn, and they used to use German POWs to help jerk sweet corn. And the camp that they kept these German POWs in was it was just across the state line in Illinois, about, well, maybe 10 miles from where my grandparents' farm was, and they would haul them out 2 farms all around the area there to jerk sweet corn. And so they would start early in the morning, and my grandmother set up a big meal for them at lunchtime, and they come into the farmyard, and we're all there eating lunch. When the German POWs realized that my grandparents speak their language. So there's a big conversation that's going on between my grandparents and some of the POWs. And in the course of one of the conversations, one of the POWs is standing with his hands on my shoulders, and he's talking to my grandparent, and one of the guards got a little spooky and thought maybe, I guess he thought the POW was going to use me to as an attempt to escape or something, because the guard started giving signs that he was about to do something. And my grandfather told him, he said, no, this is no problem at all. He said, what that German is saying is he is very concerned about, he has a son about his age, and he's very concerned about the status of his son back in Germany.
Wow.
So I've always thought that was kind of an interesting experience to be a part of.
And you remember this clearly, this whole
Yes,
this
I do, yeah.
Did you ever talk to your grandparents about what other things the POWs were talking about with them?
I might have. I probably did. I would think I would have, but I don't remember. That's the only thing I remember about that particular event.
That's really quite an amazing story.
Yeah, I find it so.
Yes. Did you have occasion, I'm sure, to think about that when you were yourself in captivity?
As a matter of fact, I did. Yeah.
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 And those POWs, how did they strike you? Was this quite a kind of a romantic thing, or was it a little scary? Or how?
No. In fact, I couldn't figure out why the guard was concerned.
Really?
I didn't sense any problem. But looking at it through the guard's eyes, I can see why he might have thought there was something amiss. But as best I can recall, my opinion of those POWs was these people are the same as everybody around this community. I could detect no difference between them and us from not being able to communicate with them.
Sure.
But they just struck me as being like anybody else. So I was a bit confused about these people don't appear to me to be the way we hear about them on the on the radio.
Yeah, there was a little mismatch there between the the rhetoric and propaganda.
Yeah, which is always the case.
Yeah. How much attention did you pay as a youngster to the war?
Not that much. The other vivid memory I have, and this tells you how old this guy is. He's old as dirt. Paul Harvey. Uh-huh. I remember my father listening to Paul Harvey on the radio when I was a kid. This would have been in 1948, 49, 50, in that time range.
Right.
How old does that make Paul Harvey? He's getting up there.
Oh, he sure is.
But at any rate, I remember that. I remember my father having maps of Europe and listening to the news and following the war on his maps. And other than that, I guess that was about the extent of my interest in the war. The other thing was my uncle, I couldn't figure out why he was so excited when they announced the end of the war. It didn't seem to be that big a thing to me, evidently, because I thought it was so unusual that he was out there blowing the horn on his car.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's about all I remember about World War II.
Now, I take it then from that you didn't have any immediate family members who were in the services. Is that fair?
That's a fair question, and the answer is that's not correct, because as you were speaking, I thought, whoa, I've got to tell Laura.
Okay.
The other big connection, and this is big. One of my uncles, my mother's brother, George Pitt, was a navigator in World War II on B-24s.
Oh, you're kidding.
Another brother, in fact, the youngest one, the one that lives on the old place now, the home place now,
sure.
He was in Japan, and there was a third brother who was stationed in Germany, or not in Germany, in England.
Mm-hmm.
So three of them were in World War II, and all three of them came home. None of them were even injured. But the one I focus on is this George, the B-24 navigator.
Sure.
Let's see, he came home in 45, so I was 11 years old, and he talked about somebody being impressed. He came home in those pink and greens, and does that term mean anything to you?
No, go ahead and explain it, please.
Army Air Corps, and it was Army Air Corps at that time before the Air Force became a separate branch.
Yes.
Army Air Corps had some cool uniforms. And what they wore was the Ike jacket, that short jacket, and kind of a green, sage green pants. It was one cool-looking uniform. And they used to, I don't know where the pink part came from, but pink and green is what they used to call them.
Okay.
And he comes home in this out in this uniform, and I am some impressed. And he starts telling some war stories, and I'm more impressed. And I'm, you know, kind of starry-eyed. Woo, wow, this is cool.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure that he influenced me. I wasn't consciously aware at the time, but years later, I'm sure that was a factor in my decision to go in the Air Force.
Now, let me just get his last name correctly.
This is not a common spelling.
Okay.
P-U-E-T-Z.
I wondered if it might be.
Does that sound a little German?
Yes, it does. Yeah. And as I said, I'm from rural Michigan, so we have a few Germans there as well. I may admit to being one of them, if pressed.
Yeah.
But so he had how many missions? Any idea?
Gee whiz, no, I don't remember. I know he flew out of New Guinea, and he probably had quite a few because he got there late. He got there, and I think he went over in late 44 and flew missions maybe November, December 44, and then 45.
Mm-hmm.
So he was fortunate in that he got there late.
Now, did he have, well, what can you tell me about the rest of his career? Did he?
No career. He, when the war was over, he came home, got out, went to Purdue.
Okay.
He only went a year or two.
Uh-huh.
And then started farming, not on the home place, but bought his own land and a farm for a few years. Then he went with the Postal Service and delivered mail for a number of years, and now retired.
Okay, well, that's quite an interesting story. I'm sure it did have some impact on you.
I would think so.
Mm-hmm. As time went on.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, tell me about your time in school. Thinking about your time either as a elementary student or as you get on into middle school and later, were you a good student, John?
Not particularly. I think I did better in grade school, and I went to the same that Dunnington school I told you about that my mother attended.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I attended that same school, and an interesting sidelight on that is, in this town of 1,000 people that I lived in, I think there were either 3 or 4 Catholic families, and that was it. And about the time that I was ready for school, these 3 or 4 families, the others also had children about my age, and the parents kind of formed some type of a group operation where they would each drive us to and from school every day, and they'd take turns on the driving.
Right.
Then after a few years, they were able to work out something with the county where they only had to drive us halfway to a residence, a farm, midway between this little town and the town I lived in, and then the buses would pick us up and take us in. But for the first 3 or 4 years, they drove us all the way to the school and picked us up in the afternoon, brought us back. So that was my elementary education. Then, as a freshman, I went to the seminary for 1 year and found out that probably wasn't going to work for me, and so just spent 1 year there. Then I went to a public high school, and what I majored in high school and my interest was girls and basketball. And once you got beyond girls and basketball, I had very little interest in anything.
Now, girls and basketball in that order?
Yes, in that order.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Although basketball was probably useful for the primary target there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. Didn't hurt.
Now, what kind of a team did you have, and who did you play in basketball?
Okay, we had a very mediocre team, and in the state of Indiana. They just went away from it about, I want to say, 7 or 8 years ago. Indiana was one of the last states I think Kentucky still does it, but Indiana was one last that you saw the movie, or you've heard of the movie Hoosiers?
Yes.
And you know the storyline.
Yes.
The little David goes up against the Goliath.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a true story. I mean, this little town of Milan did, in fact, beat Muncie Central, which was one of the bigger schools in the state of Indiana.
Sure.
So, but back to your question. In the county, I think there were about 9 little schools in the county, and the 3 years I was there, we never won a sectional tournament, which is the tournament that you have with those 9 little schools in the county, and then if you win that, you go to the next level, which was the regional.
So you guys never really got out of the county?
We never got out of the county, sad to say.
Did you have people come to the games? Did people come along?
Did people come to the games?
I mean, I know with Indiana, so
it was unbelievable.
Goes without
unbelievable. I mean,
really?
The gym would be packed with people,
yeah.
Even though we were a mediocre team. I mean, it's amazing. And now I'll give you another war story.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, here's a war story. We go forward years
mm-hmm.
forward when I'm stationed at Altus, Oklahoma.
Okay.
And the guy across the street at a tanker puke, and his son was a good jock, and he was a good basketball player. And this Altus, which is a pretty good-sized town in Oklahoma, the basketball tournament was starting.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to see his boy play in the tournament. So I'm going down to the game, and I'm running a little late for some reason or other, and I'm even considering maybe not going because I figured I won't even be able to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Running a little late. I go in, and there must have been 50 people in the gym. And I'm just flabbergasted. I'm saying, what is the deal? And evidently one of the 50 saw this look on my face and, you know, hey, what's the problem there, Sonny? And so I tell him.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, you know, what it was like back in my hometown for basketball. And he says, son, when football starts next fall, come to one of our games. You can fill in the rest of it.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir. That would be the difference between
yeah.
Oklahoma and Indiana.
You got it. Okay. So that's uh-huh. that war story.
Okay. Well, it's very interesting that you had that much enthusiasm for local games. I like sports history, so it's very interesting to me. Now, go ahead, John.
Oh, well, then you'll be happy to know that I spent Saturday in Dallas at the Cotton Bowl.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Just this past weekend?
And this is another war story.
Okay.
Do you mind me breaking into these?
These
wars?
Are fabulous. This is great.
Okay. Well, you're gonna. You won't like it because you're probably more a Texas. How do you people in Lubbock feel about the Longhorns?
I think there's general distaste.
let me rephrase the question.
Mm-hmm.
Who would you say most hate more, the Longhorns or the Sooners? Or is it about even?
Who does Texas Tech hate more?
Yeah, who does Texas
Tech?
Oh,
the Longhorns.
They do?
Yeah,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, then you'll like this story.
Okay.
Then you'll like this story. If you are part of the majority.
Well, I'm sort of more of a Michigan State fan.
Oh, that's right. You
but that's
told
okay.
me that. The Spartans.
That's
yeah.
right.
Okay.
But that's okay. Go ahead. And someone will no doubt key into this.
Okay. Okay, here's the story. Probably one of my 5 best friends is, and I have trouble making myself say this, that one of my very best friends is, 1, a lawyer, 2, he's a Dallas lawyer, and 3, he's a graduate of UT. But that's him.
Okay.
But this guy is just a fabulous human being, really is.
Mm-hmm.
Any rate, he is a big sports fan, too. In fact, the way we met was playing each other on the tennis court years and years ago. And that's how we formed our relationship and
okay.
became such good friends. But he is, I mean, he is an avid Horn fan. And in addition to being an Oklahoma fan, I'm also a Notre Dame fan. And years ago, he invited me down to Austin for a Notre Dame-Texas game, which the experts had Texas winning big. Well, as it turned out, Notre Dame kicked a field goal in the last play of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really enjoyed the ride back to Fort Worth with him.
I would think.
As we did the postmortem on the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then 5 years ago, he invited me to the Texas to the Red River Shootout, the Texas OU game.
Right.
And that year, Texas was heavily favored to win. So I wimped out and said, no, I think I'll pass. And I sat home and watched the game on television, and it was one of those wipeout games where Oklahoma just killed Texas.
Ooh.
And I was so upset that I had passed up that opportunity.
Ooh.
But fortunately, the following year, he asked me again. So then I thought, well, what the heck? I'll do it. And besides which, I had heard what an event that Red River Shootout
mm-hmm.
is.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it would be something to experience, even if OU does lose. But lo and behold, now he has invited me back every year, and I said, Courtney, you are an idiot. Don't you get the connection? It's me that's the bad omen.
Right.
As long as you let me go to this game, your horns are going to lose. And his take on it is, you are going to go to this game until Texas wins, and then you're never going again.
And then that'll be it. That'll be the end of the invitation.
So as we went home Saturday, I said, well, gee, this is really a good deal for me. I'll probably attend the rest of the Texas OU games because it looks like nothing's going to change. So that's my Texas OU story. That's my story on sports.
Well, you mentioned that you were a Notre Dame fan as well.
Yeah.
And your club certainly had the better of mine this year.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
That was a big surprise.
Yeah, that was an ouch.
Well, that was the first university that I really had any connection with as a kid.
Now, how did that come about? Just because you knew that they were there in
no,
Indiana?
No, there was something, I can't remember what the event was, but I went to the campus, and I think it was with my parents or something. I think it was like a church event or something,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I was on campus, and I guess I'd heard about the Golden Dome or something,
right.
But I do remember being very impressed with the campus. It was the first college or university campus that I'd ever been on. And I remember being impressed with that, but the closeness to where I grew up, and of course the mystique and the tradition of Notre Dame football, I guess, is what probably caused me to become a Notre Dame fan. But
yeah.
my buddy, the two things he hates the most, and he can't decide which he hates more, it's either Notre Dame or Oklahoma. Those are his two main hates.
It's a toss up.
Yeah. So we have a lot of fun. When we get together,
I guess. Well, did you give thought to going to college?
I don't think I ever did seriously consider it, and I don't know why I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't have a clear thing in mind. And oh, another story.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle, the navigator.
Yes.
Okay. I was impressed, and then another his brother, who had a little flying service on his farm in Indiana. He owned two or three little airplanes, and he was teaching other farmers around there to fly. And he was the airplane. He was had a distributorship with Aranca for the airplanes that he owned.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first flight in an airplane. He took me up one day in an airplane, and I was so impressed. I just thought, oh, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to be as a pilot. In my junior year in high school, taking the physical to play basketball, they found a heart murmur.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, and that's another story. But anyway, the next year the heart murmur, they said, well, we'll let you play as a conditional thing or something. But I just assumed being a pilot in the military was out of the question with that heart murmur.
Yeah.
So at any rate, that was a factor, and that's what I wanted. Now I know how it ties in. That's what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to be. But I thought that's not feasible. It's not possible. And I don't think I really consciously thought about school. I did think about not what I didn't want to do for a living. And one was, I didn't want to farm, and what I didn't like about farming was, and I think I would be a farmer today, because now you can raise grain and you don't have to raise livestock.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I didn't like having to take care of those livestock at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't like that they had to be fed on weekends and holidays.
Right, there's
and
no
I
break.
And I just thought, there's got to be any, and I even at my young age, I was aware of how dependent farmers were on weather, that weather determined whether they were going to be profitable or not. And I thought, this is hard work, and it's too risky, counting on the weather to be just right. There's got to be an easier way. Then while I was in this business college in Lafayette, I also worked at Alcoa running a draw bench in this aluminum plant. And I was making really good money. And I thought for the first 2 weeks, I thought it was a great job as I learned to master this piece of machinery.
Mm-hmm.
On the third week, I said, I just can't believe that people can do this for more than a year. And I knew people that had worked there for 20 and 30 years.
Right, sure.
And I knew that there was no way I could ever do something that repetitious. I mean, it got to be, I only worked there, I think, 3 months. And in the third month, every day seemed like it was mm-hmm. about a week in length. It just, mm-hmm. oh, it seemed like a day in prison.
Wow.
It was just so boring.
Wow.
So that was something I didn't want to do for a living. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I went to this business college. I always kind of liked accounting. And so I was thinking, well, I guess I'll be an accountant and see how that works.
Were you ever thinking that you might go into business with your dad?
No, I never really seriously considered that either. And the things I didn't like about that job was, in those days, not only was he the funeral director, but he had the only ambulance. And those ambulance calls coming at 1 o'clock in the morning and having to go out on those calls. And then a lot of the funerals back in those days were at the people's homes.
Yes.
So
right.
I had to haul all the chairs out to the house, take the chairs down, haul them back to the funeral home, take the flowers out, all the gopher stuff. and my dad, I remember him telling me, he said, look, he said, you can make a good living at this. And he said, I've got the goodwill built up. I've got the name.
Yes.
And it'd be a good thing for you to step into. But he said, I'm telling you, there's got to be easier ways to earn a living than this. And so he really wasn't, he wasn't that encouraging in that respect. I think he was being very candid, and I think he was disappointed that one of the three of us, one of his three boys, didn't choose to continue the funeral home. But on the other hand, he kept saying, this is a tough way to earn a living.
Sounds like he was being really straight with you.
He was. And I, you know, in retrospect, I really admire him for being up front, because I think emotionally that he would have liked to have seen one of his sons carry on the business that he started.
And I think maybe, you know, a man with lesser character might have pressured
kids
into it.
I agree.
Yeah. That is actually quite a statement about him.
And another thing about both he, and this is more my mother than him. Remember I told you I went that 1 year to the seminary?
Yes.
And it was, they were putting some pressure on me, but the way they couched it was, try it. Give
mm-hmm.
it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I am certain, as best I can recall, there was no, they didn't lean on me at all. When I told them I don't want to go back, there was nothing about trying to encourage me to go back. Their response to that was, fine, you did what we asked, and if you don't think that's for you, fine.
And they really did then leave the decision with you.
Yes. Yeah.
Where was the seminary, John?
It was a place called Wawasee, Indiana, Big Lake. Up, in fact, not too far from Notre Dame.
Yes. Okay, I wondered.
Get it working up toward your part of the world.
That's right. Well, how did you come then to the decision that you might want to try the military, since you had this sense that this wasn't going to work out for you as a pilot?
You're going to love this story.
I'll bet you I will.
You're going to love this one.
Okay.
You know how things happen in life, change our life direction, little things.
And you don't see it coming?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No clue.
Right.
No clue.
Right.
Here's the deal. Alcoa, remember? Told you that's where. What I did, I went to business college in the morning, got out of school at 2 in the afternoon, went to work at 3, worked 3 to 11
right.
at Alcoa. Well, this buddy of mine who was doing the very same thing, he decided he wanted to get in the Air Force in the worst way. And so he goes down to visit the recruiter, and he says, "Hey, come on along." He said, "Just go with me." So I thought, well, what the heck, he's my buddy, I will. So I'm sitting there on the couch reading a magazine while the recruiter is talking to my buddy. And I just happened to hear the recruiter say to my friend, "And when we send you over to Chanute for testing, we can get you out of work for 3 days at Alcoa, and no penalty. You can just have 3 days off from work." And my antenna went up, and I thought, 3 days off. And I held up my hand and said, "Hey, can I go to the Air Force?" Not knowing or suspecting that I'm not going to pass a physical anyway.
Right.
But it gets me out of work. So, of course, you can imagine how the recruiter responded.
I'll bet he jumped all over
you.
Oh,
come up here, son.
Yeah.
I mean, sit, pull up a chair. So, anyway, long story short, we both go off to Chanute for 3 days of testing. And at that time, the rules were, and they explained it to us when we were filling out all the paperwork, they said, "Okay, now for you guys that have 2 years of college, you can apply for pilot training. For those of you who do not have 2 years of college, you have to apply for navigator training." So I didn't have any I'm going to business college, mm-hmm. and that didn't count. But I thought, I'm not going to pass the test anyway, so I just wrote pilot on all my paperwork. And thought, well, I'm getting out of work. And so I go through all the testing, all that good stuff. I go back home, and life is going on. And lo and behold, about a month and a half later, I get this letter from the Air Force. "Greetings. Be advised, you have passed all of our tests, but since you do not have 2 years of college, you cannot go to pilot training, but you qualify for navigator training." George, my uncle, navigator, World War II?
Yes.
And I'm just flabbergasted. And I thought, how could I have passed that physical? But I figured, better not check into that too closely.
Right.
This opens up a whole new world of opportunity here. So I jumped on it. I thought, man, oh, yeah. I thought, I'll go to navigator school. And then from there, I can go to pilot training, which is exactly what happened. So that's how my interest was stimulated in going into the Air Force.
Did the heart murmur issue ever surface again?
After I got through nav school and my first assignment, mm-hmm. and went in for my first annual physical, I asked the flight surgeon, I told him the story.
Right.
And he said, and he had my folder there. He looked and he said, "Oh, there was no murmur at Chanute. When you took the initial test," he said, "nothing showed up." He said, "but that's typical." He said, "kids your age in high school, they have what we call functional heart murmurs, and you're still growing." And he said, "what it is, it's a valve in your heart that's not quite closing." Mm-hmm. And he said, "but as you mature, then that valve seats and closes, and everything's normal." So he said, that's not an uncommon thing at all.
So this was
it'll never show up again.
No kidding.
And so far it hasn't.
Well, knock on wood.
Yeah,
we'll go with that.
Go.
What did your folks say when you told them this?
That I do not recall. I do not recall what their response to that was. I really don't have a clue, Laura. I don't
That's
know.
Interesting.
I'm just thinking out loud. I'm thinking, well, we weren't at war then. This is 53.
Sure.
So we've just signed the armistice in Korea.
Right.
And so probably, and of course, George and his experience in World War II as a navigator, they probably thought this might be a good thing for this kid, would be my thinking on it looking back. Because I know I hadn't said anything, or there wasn't anything that I was clearly excited about or motivated toward being or doing, except being a pilot, which I had given that up when I found out I had that heart murmur.
So, and now you had a new lease on that
Oh yeah, now I'm excited again.
Do you remember reporting to basic?
I do.
How did you get down to Texas?
On a train. Rode the train down to San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
Reported to Lackland Air Force Base. And, okay, here's the next war story.
Okay, good.
So much of this, I can't remember the detail.
That's okay.
Where were the rest of the guys? I know there were some other guys. But what I'm thinking is, I think the rest of them were going to basic, where I was going to pre-flight.
Okay.
And I think what happened is, somebody told all the guys that were going to basic training where to go, and they said, you're in pre-flight, you're over there somewhere. And they just kind of pointed a direction and probably gave me a building number. But the part I remember, though, is I'm walking around looking for probably a building, and I'm walking by these open barracks, and up on the second floor, I see a guy in a window. So I said, hey, do you know where building such and such is? And he said, yes, I know where building such and such is. And I said, well, where is it? And he said, first, what do you mean walking down this sidewalk and saying, hey, do you know where such and such a building is? You should say, sir, do you know where? Anyway, after about a 45-second conversation,
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, I wonder if I can get back on that train and go back to Boswell.
Right.
This really isn't what I want. So that was my initial impression of the Air Force.
So he took the opportunity to give you the dickens there.
Yeah, he indoctrinated me very quickly as to what life was going to be like in pre-flight. And boy, did he give me an accurate picture of what it was going to be like.
He wasn't lying, huh?
He was not lying. In fact, that was really mild as to what came on. But, Laura, let me share with you, and I've shared this with so many people.
Sure.
The psychology, how people work on your mind.
Yes.
And this probably would be maybe of interest to you. And it really, really depressed me. And when I thought about it, and this is a couple of years later, but I was the exact type of person that they looked for coming in there. As they harassed us in the training, my response to that was, if you think you're going to force me out of this program, you are wrong. And my only goal in life was to show them that I could take it. And it wasn't until a couple years after I had been commissioned and out in the field that it finally dawned on me one day, you idiot, that's exactly the way they wanted you to think about that. That's what they wanted. So you thought you were showing them, you fell right into their trap. That's what they wanted you to do. So
if you had to characterize what it was that they were pulling out of you and counting on pulling out of you, what kind of words would you use?
I would say that they were looking for someone who, when faced with adverse conditions or something, if they really felt strongly enough about what they were doing or about something, if they had some core value, that they would do about anything to follow that. That's what I think they were looking for.
So standing up under pressure.
Yes, and mm-hmm. I think that's why they had such a high washout rate. Was their thinking was, if we get rid of those people that are not inclined to resist this, it's going to save us a lot of money in the long run.
Yeah, a lot of money, a lot of trouble.
Yeah, that was my impression. But
it was
such a come down because I was so proud of myself that I had showed them, and it was only later that I realized just the way they set the program up.
Then your whole house of cards kind of.
Yeah, yeah. Collapsed. I thought, oh yeah, yeah. You really showed them.
Yeah. Good job, John.
Yeah, good. Oh boy, John, you showed them who's in the Air Force, who's signed up. Yeah.
Well, how many guys were in the pre-flight class?
Oh, let's see.
Roughly.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I would guess there must have been about 200.
Is that right?
Yeah, because I think half of the class went to Harlingen, which is where I went, and the other half went to Ellington. So probably a couple hundred. But, boy, that's just a wag. I mean, it could have been No, it had to be at least 50 to 100, no less than that. And I would, just thinking about the size of our class, I think we had about 90 or 100 in our class.
Is that right?
When we started at Harlingen.
Uh-huh. And was that, in a sense, was the time at Harlingen, that's NAV school, right?
Yeah.
And that was after about how long at Lackland?
Lackland was at the 3 months. 3 months okay. At Lackland, and then it was almost a year at Harlingen.
Now, just on Lackland for a minute, was there attrition in the class while you were there, or did that really come later?
Most of it. Let's see. Yeah, there was attrition at Lackland. I really don't have a good feel for what the percentage was.
Sure.
And nor do I have a good feeling for the attrition rate at Harlingen. But I think it was fairly high. I would say that overall, all of us that started at pre-flight
right.
and then came out the other end of the pipeline, I'd guess maybe about a 30% attrition rate.
Wow. that's heavy.
Yeah, and as I recall, and again, this is just from a fuzzy memory, but I think most of the attrition occurred early. It occurred early, like in the first couple of weeks at Lackland, and then again, once we went on to Harlingen, it occurred early there
mm-hmm.
in the first couple of months.
Interesting. Tell me a little bit, if you can, about the routine at Lackland. What was it that they were actually trying to get you to pick up during that three-month period?
Well, the thing that I recall was the eating square meals, being constantly intimidated by the upper class. You always had to turn square corners. You had to march everywhere, like I say, eating a square meal. You had to learn the George Washington's rules of war. You had to know the chain of command. You had to have all this stuff memorized. And if you, whenever you gave an incorrect answer, or if you weren't marching in the proper manner, or if you did anything wrong, they used to do what they called gig you. You had these slips of paper that you had to carry in your pocket all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we called them gig slips. And so you had to give the upperclassmen a gig slip. And they kept track of those, how many you had. And depending upon how many you had to walk on the tour path, and which meant marching for an hour. And that's the part I remember, was the constant harassment. I don't even remember much of the training, the basic military training I received. I just remember the harassment. And then after I was commissioned, got out in the field and learned a little bit more about Annapolis and West Point,
mm-hmm.
realized that what we were plebes. We were first-year cadets, like being at Annapolis and West Point, and I know that that's what they built that cadet program around, was to compress it into a year. The first year, really, they made it a lot like the first year at a military academy.
Absolutely. It sounds very similar.
Yeah, that's what it was, a microcosm, really, of the 4 years at the military academy. Although, you know, the worst year at a military academy is that plebe year, that first year. That's when you get all the harassment.
And
of course, I'm sure they figure if they make it through the first year, they're keepers.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there's the washouts really.
Yeah, so we had it for the whole year that we were in cadets. But it was only for a year.
Now, that year at Harlingen, what would you say were the main things that they were trying to get across to you? Was it technical information? Was it conformity? Was it something else?
No, it was technical information.
Okay. Uh-huh.
They were really, that program was really there. They were there. The purpose of the program was to train you to be a navigator, but the thing that was unique about it, as an aviation cadet, you still had this harassment, this lower class, upper class thing that you went through. And so it was a two-pronged attack. In fact, one of the things I remember very clearly about Harlingen was About half of our class were cadets, and the other half were ROTC guys. And the ROTC guys, of course, had none of this harassment, none of this cadet stuff. They were already officers, so they just went to school. Mm-hmm. And here we were, as cadets, having to put up with all this harassment stuff, plus the same curriculum that they were studying. So we resented very much the ROTC guys.
I'll bet.
But the and another interesting thing about that program, this is 1954, and it was a lot of the curriculum had to do with electronics, with equipment. And the philosophy at that time was that you were going to be kind of an in-flight technician. If there was problems with your equipment, they were going to have you so knowledgeable in electronics that you could repair the equipment in flight, which was really a dumb, dumb philosophy.
Why do you say that, John?
Well, because none of us ever did it. We never, I never did. I know my fellow navigators that I talked to, I said, did you ever repair any equipment in flight, particularly anything that all those classes we had in electronics would have prepared you for? And nobody else did either. My feeling was they should have focused more on basic navigation, like how to operate a sextant, how to navigate, that type stuff, which we got a lot of, too. But, in fact, the proof of this was that a few years later, they really dramatically reduced the electronic portion of the curriculum.
Now, I'm just throwing this out there as a possibility. Was some of that change driven by the fact that the actual components themselves were becoming so sophisticated that there's no way during a flight that you're going to be popping them open?
I think that did have something to do with it.
Yeah.
And also the fact that that what it became as the electronic equipment became more sophisticated, then all you had to do was pull out a black box. You had to have enough knowledge to know that, well, if this is what I'm experiencing with this radar set, it's probably this black box. So you had to be knowledgeable enough to know which black box to remove and replace. But you'd pull it out, and if you had it, and you'd have spares, and just plug a spare into the air in and see if that fixed the problem, which didn't require any electronic knowledge. It just a knowledge of which black boxes were probably going to be the culprit if you had a particular problem.
So you needed to know the system.
Had to know the system, but you didn't have to have so much electronic knowledge.
Then you had these interchangeable components that
that's
you could
correct.
Pull
out. That was later, though.
Yeah. How much later, would you say?
Oh, gee whiz. Let's see. I know they were going to that probably 5 or 6 years after I went through.
So around 60 or so?
Yeah.
Okay. How did you do with the mathematics behind the navigation element?
I was pleasantly surprised. I think I know overall in my class of about 90, I think my overall standing was like 6th or 7th. And
that's not bad.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased with myself. My highest grade was in the training in flight when we flew in the airplane, and the actual navigation, that's where I did the best. And then academically, I was good, and my worst grade was the military.
Why was that, John?
They used to have what they called group boards, and a group board's where you had to go before the upper class cadets, and if your violation was bad enough that it required a group board, that's what you had to do. You had to appear before the board, and then the board meted out the punishment for you. And I and one other guy tied for the highest number of group boards during our tenure as cadet. I had a problem with this harassment thing. And you know the old thing about I'll show you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That got in my way a lot, caused me a lot of grief. I would have played it differently had I been a little smarter.
So your resistance actually kind of crossed over the line to...
Yeah, caused me a lot of grief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you set a record basically for most most group boards.
Yeah. And then probably you're thinking, now come on, John, if you tied a record for the most group boards, if your military bearing was that bad, how did you end up that high in your class? Well, this is something they corrected, too. At that time, fortunately for me, your military standing was how you were ranked by your peers rather than your superiors, the officers who ran the program. Now, why they did that, I have no idea, but I am sure they used me as an example to change that.
They became the poster child for it.
Yeah, they probably said, look at this idiot. Tied for the number of group boards, and yet his classmates rating off the chart in military bearing. Now, go figure.
This screams out for reform.
Yeah, this is saying, do we have a popularity contest here rather than military bearing? So that was changed, fortunately, after I went through.
Well, during this period, in speaking to other navigators trained through the same kind of process that you went through, I've heard one or two say that the intensity of the training sort of killed the joy around flying. And they weren't becoming pilots, they weren't training to be pilots, but they were excited about flight, and the pressure cooker took some of that away. And did you have any feeling like that, John, or was it the opposite? Or
My feeling, to me, going through nav school, being a navigator, I was excited because of my relationship with my uncle and the stories I'd heard him tell.
I see. Okay.
That had me excited. Yeah. I loved flying, but the part I loved about flying was flying the airplane, being the pilot, if you will.
Right.
So
right.
To me, navigation, my motivation as a navigator, to graduate as a navigator, was so that I could then go to pilot training.
And you kept that clearly in view?
Yeah, but what I didn't realize, again, because I had no military experience, if I'd been a little smarter, the normal way of going for most people was they washed out of pilot training and then they would go to nav school. In fact,
yes.
I ran into a lot of contemporaries of mine later, and they were always surprised that I did it backwards. Mm-hmm. In fact, just before you called, I talked to a buddy of mine from Boswell, Indiana, who was a navigator, and that's what he did. He went to pilot training, washed out, and then went to nav school, which is the way most people ended up as navigators.
Yes.
Anyway, back to the motivation part of it. The academics, although I couldn't see the rationale for all this electronic training, it was interesting. I found it interesting. And so that probably helped me out academically, too, because I had an interest in it. And so that kept me motivated. But I would say, in hindsight, the thing that motivated me most was throughout the whole program was I was going to show them. I was going to show them that they couldn't drive me out of the program. I didn't care what they did. I was going to show them. As it turned out, I was very fortunate because when I went through nav school, your assignments were determined by your class ranking. So I really more or less had my choice of assignments coming out of nav school.
Now, you finished in early 55, is that
yeah,
is that
7 April 1955.
Now, that's when you were commissioned?
Correct, and given my navigator wing, same day.
Okay, and was it at that time also that you were putting forward your choice, or had you already done that?
I'd say it was about a week before graduation.
Okay.
When they came down with the assignments and the class standing.
So you already knew where you were off to?
The first thing they did is they said, okay, here's the class standing. Here's where you are in your class. Mm-hmm. Then they posted all the assignments. And they said, okay, number one in the class, here are 90 assignments. Which one do you want? And so on. That's the way it worked.
Okay, and you got, you had a pretty good choice because where you finished.
Correct.
What did you choose?
I chose, now don't laugh, Doctor. I chose the ferry command.
And that was based in California?
Correct.
That
is correct.
Okay, what was your thinking?
Are you ready for another war story?
Absolutely.
Okay, here we go. J.T. Bailey and I, my buddy, he was a couple of notches ahead of me, and he was from New Jersey, so he was much more worldly and knowledgeable than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was leaning heavily toward this ferry command assignment, in Sacramento, California. But his motivation was Sacramento, California. Since he grew up in New Jersey, he wanted to see the left coast. So he told me, he said, I think I'm going to take one. And there were two assignments, by the way, to this ferry command. He said, I think I'm going to take one of those to Sacramento. And I was torn between that and Miami, because on an out-and-back, a weekend out-and-back NAV flight, we had RON at Miami International. And I thought Miami was pretty cool. And I was flip-flopping back and forth between those two. Well, this guy that was about number 11 or 12 in the class, he had also been on that out-and-back. And while we were in Miami, he fell in love. And so he was really beating on me to go to Sacramento so he could get that Miami slot. And then, as luck would have it, one day, while we're in this process, I just happened to overhear two of the instructors, officers, and I just happened to overhear a conversation they were having. And the conversation was, can you believe that there are two assignments to that ferry command out in McClellan Air Force Base up on that list? And the other guy said, I can't believe that. He said, I would give anything for one of those assignments. And so I ran to my buddy JT and I said, JT, we are going to that ferry command. And he said, why is that? And I said, I don't know. But I said, these two officers, and you know officers know everything.
Right.
And they think it's the greatest assignment in the world, and they're all bent out of shape because they can't go to it.
And they were, this is just a chance overhearing.
Overhearing this conversation because we as cadets, most of them were like me, had no clue about the military. We'd never been in the military before. We didn't know SAC from TAC from nothing. And we were going strictly by location.
Right.
And then when I overheard that conversation, well, that cemented the deal because I was thinking about Sacramento or Miami anyway. And I told my buddy, I said, man, that's got to be a great assignment because I heard these two guys and I told him what the conversation was. So that's how I ended up picking McClellan and the ferry command.
Now, did it turn out to be a good choice, John?
I've told people that in my 25 years in the Air Force, that was my second best assignment. The best assignment I ever had was when I was in B-58s at Grissom Air Force Base. But the second best assignment was that ferry command at McClellan.
And why do you say that?
Okay. Are you ready for a couple, 3 minutes of this?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, here's the deal.
Okay.
Brand new second lieutenant, say?
Yes.
We're right out of Harlingen Air Force Base. We're going out into the real Air Force world. And JT and I report in. In fact, I was with another guy that this outfit, we only had about 8 navigators in it. And I just got back about 2 hours ago from San Antonio and spent the night with this guy who was also in the same organization at the same time.
And really?
I was telling him about when JT and I walked in and reported for duty to Major Ball. Major Ball was a Tuskegee Airman. And I didn't know it at the time.
Is that right?
I knew it was black, but I didn't know he'd been a Tuskegee Airman. And great guy. But anyway, JT and I report in, and he's sitting there shaking his head and giving this look to, and I've never reported for duty before, and what's the deal here? And he said, sit down. And so then he says, look, guys, he said, let me tell you something. He said, he kind of was reinforcing what I'd overheard those two officers say back at Harlingen. He said, I do not understand why the Air Force sends cadets, guys right out of cadets, to this assignment. He said, this assignment is for some old captain who has been a navigator in SAC for years and years, getting beat up on, and this should be his reward assignment. He said, this is terrible to send you brand new guys here. He said, if you forget everything else that I tell you while you're here, remember this. This is not the real Air Force. The Air Force is not like this organization. Remember that, please. Then, as the 3 years I was in that organization unfolded, I learned more and more what it was he was talking about. For example, in the 3 years I was in that ferry command, I probably had an Air Force uniform on maybe three or four times.
No kidding.
The only time that I had what could pass for a flight suit was when we were ferrying airplanes. We ferried airplanes just one direction. Either we took them from the plant to the receiving organization, which was almost always in the Far East. We had another sister organization on the East Coast at Dover, Delaware, which ferried airplanes out to Europe. But at any rate, we either ferried them one way to the receiving organization or old airplanes that we were ferrying back to the States to either go to Davis-Monthan or go to other units within the States. So that meant we flew commercial one way on almost every trip.
Wow.
Yeah, well, now it gets better.
Okay.
It gets better.
Uh-huh.
We were acting, they made all of us, the seven or eight navigators in this unit, they designated us on orders as acting transportation officers. What that meant is they gave us blank TRs, travel requisitions. They just gave us blank TRs. We filled them in on where, how we were going to route ourselves. The briefing that Major Ball gave JT and I was, when we got to this part, he said, now look, we've got a real good deal going here with these TRs.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and if you're coming back or going to pick up an airplane and there's some place you want to go and spend a day or two, that's fine, as long as it's roughly on your route of flight.
Okay.
He said, I don't want something ridiculous coming in here like you're going from Sacramento to San Francisco by way of Honolulu. That's not going to cut it.
Right.
So that was a great deal.
It needed to look reasonable.
Yeah, okay. You had to look reasonable. Uh-huh. But being a second lieutenant as an acting transportation officer, routing yourself on commercial air, not too shabby. Then, in fact, United Airlines set up an office in our building just for the only purpose of the office was to book us on United as much as they could. The deal was, they said, look, when you've got a trip, come to us, tell us where you want to go, and we'll take care of your booking for you. And then they made us a member of their 100,000-mile club and all this, which was a forerunner of Advantage and the American Advantage, all that stuff.
Right, all the frequent flyers.
Yeah, all that stuff.
The million-mile club.
Yeah,
and all
right,
that.
Same deal.
Wow.
And then the other thing was there were no additional duties. I mean,
you're kidding.
When you got back from a trip, when you ferried an airplane, we had a real, real involved, complex system of scheduling. We had each our seven or eight names on little boards and with little nails on this board. And your name, when you came back from the trip, you went to the bottom of the board. And then you worked your way up. So when you came back from a trip and you're on the bottom of the list, you'd say, well, hey, I think I'll go down to L.A. for a week. And they'd say, okay, call in at 10 o'clock every morning and see if we got anything moving. And that's all you had to do. You had to call in at 10 o'clock every morning and check to see where you were on this board, if you'd moved up or if you were still in the same place, what it was. That was it.
So you'd know how quickly you had to be to beat back home.
Yeah, what you knew was when you came home, when you got back home from a trip,
right,
you knew you were on the bottom of the list. And then, depending upon how many airplanes you were ferrying at that particular time, if things were fast or things were slow, you could say, well, it's probably going to be 2 or 3 weeks before I go out on another trip. So what you had to look forward to was 2 or 3 weeks of picking up the phone at 10 o'clock in the morning, calling in, saying, where am I on the board? Oh, you're number 5. Okay, thank you. And that was it.
And calling in from wherever you happen to be.
Wherever you happen to be. Mm-hmm. Now, they kind of wanted you to be in the local area, which we were anyway most of the time, but if you just had come back from a trip and
right,
things were slow and you said, well, I would like to go down to Southern Cal for a week, they'd say, fine, go ahead, but call in. And if something unplanned for comes up, if we have to ferry a lot of airplanes quick, you may have to come back. But that never happened.
But, yeah, you could just about handle that risk.
Oh, you got that right. The bottom line being, that was one hell of a good deal. And Major Ball was right. That should have been a reward assignment for some guy that had a bad assignment for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
The proof of it was, and while I'm in this assignment, as soon as I can, I apply for pilot training. I'm accepted, but I've got about a 2.5-year wait. And someone in the Air Force finally got smart enough to realize that they really didn't need a ferry command anymore, so they disbanded it. And I was about 3 months out from my pilot training date, so they sent me to Travis Air Force Base in California to be a navigator on C-97. That was considered a choice navigator assignment at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I go in there, and these other navigators they could not believe me, because all I'm doing is complaining. What do you mean I've got to come in if I'm not flying? What do you mean I've got to turn in a log when I get back? I mean,
they were running things a little tighter down there.
Yeah, and these other navigators saying, what is it with you, Yule? This is a choice assignment for
right.
a navigator.
And you were having a little adjustment.
Yeah, I
issue.
Said, not in my book, it's not a choice assignment. I just came from the choice assignment.
Wow.
So it was, well, that's what I always tell people. I say, second best assignment I ever had in the Air Force was my one assignment as a navigator.
And the best one was which years?
Was 1960, late 66 through the beginning of 1970.
At Grissom. Okay, well, we'll get to that. I just want to ask you, John, a couple of questions. Is there anything else you can tell me about Major Ball, his first name, for example?
Howard.
And
H-O-W-A-R-D.
What else did you learn about him while you were there?
Not that much, because once we reported in, and I told you what life was like in that organization.
Yes, uh-huh.
You never saw other people in the organization unless they were your buddies.
Okay.
And I just don't remember another thing. The only thing I remember about Major Ball, you know, seeing him around once in a while, and he'd say, how you doing, John? You know, something like that. That'd
mm-hmm.
be about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that initial meeting, I remember very well. But other than that, I just don't remember very much about him.
At what point did you find out what his flying record had been?
Two or three. It was just 2 or 3 years ago. In fact, it was this guy that I was telling you about that I visited in San Antonio yesterday.
Yeah.
He told me 2 or 3 years ago. He asked me. He said, "Hey, did you know that Howard Ball had been a Tuskegee Airman?" And I said, "No." He said, "I had an Air Force magazine." And he said, they had a picture of a group picture of some Tuskegee Airmen.
Sure.
He said, I was just scanning through it, and he said Howard Ball was in that group. And that was the first I knew. So I didn't know until a couple of years ago.
That's really interesting that it never came up.
Yeah, never did, and he never mentioned it. Of course, to us, you know, we would have, you know what our response would have been? What's a Tuskegee Airmen?
Right. This is the thing about history. We see things differently now.
Yes, isn't that the truth?
Did you ever pick up anything on the edge of conversations with him? I know you didn't see him all that much, but that suggested there might have been some race-based tension there?
Never did.
Really? That's interesting.
But I got another great war story for you about that.
Go for it.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah,
I hate to keep jumping around on you.
No,
like
this is terrific. This is great.
See,
you
prompt my memory circuit and make me think of something.
Good.
In fact, there's two of them, two race-based war stories.
Okay.
In fact, chronologically, we're right in line here because we're just about ready to go to pilot training, eh?
Sure.
Okay. We're in the second phase of pilot training, mm-hmm. which is at Enid, Oklahoma. This is in 1959, early 1959.
Okay.
And you remember what the racial tensions were in
yes,
this
sir.
Country back, or what the situation
and
was.
In Oklahoma? Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. You got the picture.
Yes.
Okay. So we're stationed in Enid, and probably my best friend at Enid in the second phase of pilot training was a guy named Al Daniels. Al Daniels was built about like Roy Williams, our Oklahoma Sooner football player who we have on loan to the Dallas Cowboys now.
Yeah.
But that's about the way Al Daniels was built. In fact, I never could figure out how he ever got in that T-33. But great guy. But big, muscular guy, and just a fun guy. And there were about four of us guys that kind of piled around together all the time. And there were two of the four. This other guy was Catholic, too, and we had this little thing where we'd go to Mass on Sunday, and then we'd go to this motel for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a habit. We did it for many, many weeks. And one day, somehow or another, I don't know how that came up in the conversation, but we said, hey, Al, how about you and Bill? Anyway, the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you guys join us for breakfast next Sunday? We always go to Mass at whatever time it was. And we go to breakfast at this President's Hotel, I think was the name of it. So the other guy says, oh, yeah, that sounds good to me. And Al is hesitant. You know, he said, I don't know about that. He said, come on, Al. He said, well, we got a problem there. And I said, what do you mean a problem? He said, well, I said, blacks aren't allowed in that motel. You know, and we're kind of two things. I mean, we're halfway through pilot training, so we're pretty cocky.
Sure.
Top Gun. You know, we kind of got that Top Gun mentality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, we're white. We don't really know what Al's probably put up with in his life. But I guess we go back to the cocky part. And we put a little heat on him, saying, come on, Al, you wimp. Let's go. Let's press to test this hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, let me talk to his wife. And so he did, and they reluctantly agreed. So off we go this Sunday morning, and I can still remember the eight of us, the four guys and the four wives, walk in. And you know the normal crowd noise in a place, and
sure,
they were doing a pretty good business this Sunday morning. We walked in, and that place, you could hear a pin drop in there. It got real quiet. And so we walk over and we sit down, and we look over at the behind the counter, and here are three or four heads together, and they're having a pretty animated conversation. And you know the conversation is, what are we going to do?
Right.
And I guess what they did was went to the manager, and because time passed, and then this one of them finally came over and said, may I help you? Took our order, and from then on, we went to the motel. Now, in hindsight, what we think probably happened was that the manager's thinking, yeah, I get a lot of business from that Enid Air Force Base,
yeah,
and I don't know if I want to lose that business. And so they served it. But that was one. Second one.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going backwards because in primary, the first 6 months in pilot training, I was at Bainbridge, Georgia.
Okay.
And a little, this little town of Bainbridge, and we rented this little house next to the person that owned the house and his big house. He had built this smaller house for his son who had died kind of tragically, and so the house was vacant and he rented it to us. And his gardener, I tried to get that guy to come in the house a couple of times. He would not come in the house. And my wife, Rose, a Canadian, who had never experienced anything in the South, was really having a hard time understanding what that was all about. So that was another racial thing. Then the third one was, and this is going after pilot training,
mm-hmm,
stationed at Altus, Oklahoma, in B-52s. Our next door neighbors were Air Force. He was an electronic warfare officer. He had gone through CASEL, through training with me, and we were pretty good friends and lived next door to him.
Right.
And one day there was someone coming around the neighborhood selling memberships to some club in town there, a dinner club or something like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
And they came, it just so happened they visited our house first, and then they went to Harold and Marty's house. And we didn't know at the time, but we found out later that they just said, oh, excuse us, we must have the wrong house. And they left. And I guess that evening we were across the fence or doing something and mentioned, hey, did you have anybody come by here today trying to sell you a membership to this club? And Marty said, she said, no, but somebody did come to the door, and we checked the time. It was the same time. And when I opened the door, they just kind of had this surprised look on their face, and they said, oh, this must be the wrong house, and they left. Well, we put two and two together on that. So we confronted the people. We had bought the membership. So we confronted them and said, hey, What about our neighbors next door? That they're interested in joining that. And, of course, they didn't know who our neighbors were, the people at the...
Sure.
And they said, oh, well, no problem.
Great, you know, yeah.
He's in the Air Force? Oh, yeah, he's an officer? Oh, yeah, well, no problem. Well, then we found out there was a problem. So we told all of our friends, we said, hey, if you signed up for this thing, they won't let Harold and Marty, they won't let them join, so we're not going to join. And so all the Air Force people backed out of it. Now, I don't know if anything ever happened after that. With that, because we just never paid any attention to
that. What was Harold's last name?
Baudouit, B-A-U-D-U-I-T. And he had some stories that would make your eyes water about some of the things he ran into in his earlier life.
Do you remember any of those, John, that you could pass on to us?
The only one that I remember, no, I don't remember specifically, but
sure.
I remember in general,
mm-hmm.
because he and Marty were describing, I guess Rose and I had just been back to Indiana, and we'd talked about in motels or something we'd stayed in. And they were telling us about when they went back. I think they were back from the East Coast somewhere. But how they had to plan a trip. They had to plan. They had to plan where they could stay, where they could eat, where they could stop. I mean, it just blew me away when they were explaining how detailed their planning had to be.
To avoid segregated facilities.
Yeah, when they would travel cross country. And unfortunately, Harold had a huge chip on his shoulder, which is understandable to me. I mean, I could easily understand why he was so upset.
Mm-hmm.
Marty was more even-tempered. She just kind of blew it off with the times, you know, and said, hey, that's the way some people are. But Harold had a problem with it.
He had a harder time with
he had a hard time dealing with
it.
And it really caused him some problems in the squadron because most of the people in the squadron were willing to accept him, but it just bothered him so much that he really turned a lot of people off.
Was he out front about what it was that... Was he confrontational?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I used to really give him a rash of trash. I said, Harold, you should have been a lawyer. Postscript. After he got out of the Air Force, he went to law school and became a lawyer. But I told him, I said, you should be a lawyer. You love to argue. I said, you'll argue any damn point. And one time I told Rose, I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get into one of our normal discussions with Harold that'll be emotional. And so I did. And I said, and then the next night I'm going to take the opposite side and see what he does. So then the next time we got together, I did. I just took the total opposite approach of what I'd done three nights before.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, he goes the other way so we could have this argument going. I told him, I said, you just love to argue. You like that arena. But I think he was very combative and meant no words about how he felt about things.
As you point out, though, the background of his life had probably shaped a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was very understandable why he felt like he did.
Do you know where he was from originally?
Oh, boy, I want to say, like, Virginia. One of those states in there,
uh-huh.
I think. And Marty, I think, was from, I want to say East Coast also. I think they were both from the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah, and although there were variances there, that would make being in Oklahoma.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's difficult.
That is correct. And I think that was a factor also.
You've mentioned Rose a couple of times, and I just, and that she was Canadian, or is Canadian. Is she still with you?
I'm sorry?
Is she still with you?
Yeah, but it's on a trial basis.
Okay. but she's from Canada, correct?
Yes.
And where had you met her?
In Sacramento, California.
Okay, so during this very sweet assignment that you had.
That's correct.
Okay.
You ready for another war story?
Absolutely.
Okay, here we go. Another friend of mine who was in another, he was in cadets with me in my class, one of my good buddies going
mm-hmm.
through cadets. He went to Sacramento also, but he was in this other outfit, not the ferry command. And he was a silver-tongued devil. He was so smooth, he should have been a politician. And at any rate, he and I are going to meet at the McClellan O Club, and we're going to go downtown and run them and see what we can scare up. And so that's going to be our meeting point. So I get there before he does. And there are these girls at the club who I'd never seen before. It turned out they were some nurses from the hospital, of one of which was Rose Ellen O'Neill. And she's at a table with two other girls. And I thought, you know, I better check this out before I start going downtown.
Mm-hmm.
This looks like it has possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I go over there and start chit-chatting and doing fairly well, I think, until my buddy shows up, Billy Byer shows up. And then he starts in. And this is where the stories diverge.
Okay.
This is my version. If you talk to Rose, her version is totally opposite. But I swear to you, Doctor, he was making headway until he happened to say, "Oh, you're from Canada, Canuck, huh?" And God, she goes ballistic. He said, "No, I'm not a Canuck. I'm a Canadian. There's a big difference." And you can tell she is mad. Well, I thought that was really cool. One is because I'm seeing my silver-tongued buddy go down in flames
here
in front of my very eyes. And two is, I think maybe I might be back in the game. And three is, I had never seen a woman come on that strong about something over something like that. And I thought, whoa, this needs to be checked out.
Right, she's got something going on.
Yeah, and the rest is history. Now, here, Nick, again, our stories diverge. I tell people, yeah, the reason she went to Sacramento was because she picked up one of those nurses' magazines up there in St. John, and it said, "Sacramento, California, land of sunshine and brand new second lieutenant, very gullible." And I said, she just went out there because she knew it was a target-rich environment. As you can imagine, her story's a little different.
Yeah, well, we may have an opportunity to speak with her at some point and get this all cleared up.
Yeah, well, she lies, and I speak nothing but the truth.
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
Yeah, so at any rate, that's how we met. And let's see, that would have been, I guess, now she told, when did she tell me we met? I can't remember. I think it was like in, it must have been in like in June or July. That would have been in 55. And then she said I asked her to marry her in a week, and I don't know if that's true or not, but she didn't say yes until the following December.
Okay.
And then the following April is when we got married.
So you were married in 1956?
Correct.
Okay. You've had, am I correct in thinking, 7 children?
That is correct.
Okay, wow. What a terrific family. John, let's go ahead and take a break there.